Welcome to Community in Code, the podcast where we talk to the human beings behind the commits. I'm here today with Troy Chaplin, a front-end developer, a WordPress engineer, one of the organizers of WordCamp Canada, and also the author, I believe, of the block validation plugin that does block accessibility validation plugin on WordPress.org, where that checks whether your Gutenberg blocks are accessible or not. Welcome to the show, Troy.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Chris.
Yeah, no worries. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do with WordPress.
I grew up in a small town in Newfoundland. I found I was always involved in something creative, whether it be art, design, drawing. I drew constantly on walls and all kinds of stuff. So as I got older, I started to get into what ended up becoming graphic design. I spent the first 10 years of my career being a graphic designer and doing a lot of print production materials, books, magazines, you name it, I probably did it. But halfway through that point in my career, I realized that print was probably not going to be my future. So I decided to start teaching myself web. And a friend of mine had told me quite early on, he had discovered WordPress. And he said to me, this is probably 2016, 2017. And he said to me, look, I found this really cool thing called WordPress, and I think it might be something big. We should kind of follow this. And, a couple of years after that, I got lucky to go and join my friend at Carleton University as a web developer. And we started the transformation across campus, moving away from a legacy content management system into a custom-built WordPress enterprise solution.
That's awesome. Yeah, I spent a lot of my early development career being afraid to call myself a developer. I refer to myself as a web designer, not a developer, because I also was way more into the like graphical side of things. I taught myself HTML, but I didn't really consider that coding. I took like graphic design and things in college, and I was more like interested in that. But then I discovered, by accident, really, that because I started learning WordPress also, and there was a point at which I was working with a local web designer who needed a developer, a backend developer, to do this thing for a site that he was building, because he was really just front-end focused. And when I didn't have to worry about the design stuff, I realized that I really liked doing the work a lot more because you don't have to follow all of the trends. And that was a thing that, like, we were, my partner and I were freelancing, and that was a thing that was kind of a struggle, is like the web design trends were always changing. We wanted to kind of put our own sort of mark on the sites that we built, but also we needed to like pay attention to what other sites were doing and looking like. And when I didn't have to make those calls, it made my job a lot easier.
Yeah. Design is a tough business because everybody's got their opinion. And they all can look at something and tell you exactly what they like and what they don't like, and it's not always rooted in design principles, and it makes it really tough for myself. I don't really think I was the best designer. I just had the understanding, and I could take a design and I could create five other templates with it. Mm-hmm. So that's where my strengths were, and that's something that I leaned on quite heavily as I made the transition from a graphic designer into a web developer. I got the opportunity to work with a really great web designer, and it made my life easier by being able to take those templates and kind of just build them out into something bigger. But I really definitely enjoy the coding side of it more, like taking those designs, seeing it come to life on page, seeing how users would interact with it and how they felt about the site and what their feedback was really exciting to me at the time. Like being able to take something that came from my head and then put it out into the world and seeing people use it was really interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about a little bit about what it's like, the needs or demands of working within sort of the EDU space, because I know that there's a lot of very sort of specific things that educational institutions are like very focused on and interested in that aren't necessarily the same as like a regular quote unquote regular website or like an enterprise website. Actually, there's some probably correlations with enterprise websites in some degrees. But like I know that the EDU space is a very sort of world unto itself.
Yeah, I guess there's several areas. Like the world that I work within, I look at it as a typical agency style environment where, while we do have one main brand and one template that we try to adhere to at all times, there's 800 different sites and at least eight over, or definitely over 1,000 content editors, and they all have different things they want, different needs. So I treat them as individual clients, and I think that's the best approach, where we look at what their needs are. Now, I think what it makes us a bit different from enterprise is that you work with that one client, but we have to take that information back and figure out, is this something that can be used for a wider audience? And then what would those requirements be? And how can we make it so we don't build one-off things all over the place? And how can we leverage it for, more goals?
And is that that collection that collection of 800 sites, is that 800 individual single site WordPress installations, or is that one massive WordPress multi-site, or is it like a combination of the two?
So for many years, we were doing single installations. I think at some point we got to maybe 200 or so, 250 sites, and realized that maintaining these individual installations with, individual file folders was not gonna be sustainable for much longer. We looked at a bunch of different solutions. Like Deploy HQ was a really good one for us, where that was able to deploy from GitHub and push up to our servers, and it handled it. But again, it was slow. Like the process would take almost a full day, if not overnight. Myself and a colleague, Mike, had developed a tool called WordPress Multi-Tenant. So we took WordPress and we built a multi-tenant application with it. So we leveraged Composer. So we were handling all the installation through Composer. At the time, not a lot of premium plugins offered the ability to download with Composer. So we started just maintaining our own repos with a Composer file to make our lives easier. And then through the use of symlinks, we were able to create an environment where we had one centralized set of resources from WordPress to the plugins to our themes. But then each of the individual sites would use a symlink to point to where that centralized location was. So we still maintained individual databases and individual installations for each site, but we finally were able to move into a singular code base. And that significantly improved our working life and our workflow and, everything that comes with that. Now though, with our more modern setup, we're moving into a hybrid theme. We're not ready for block themes just yet, but we're moving into a hybrid theme. It's all Gutenberg powered. We have decided to go multi-site with that one. So we're currently going through a process of migrating those 800 and something sites into our new multi-site environment.
Is there, do you have like when you're working with content editors, I know, so like at Pantheon, one of the things that we do is we have this concept of upstreams, which is similar to sort of like the thing that you were talking about, where it's like it's basically you have a centralized repository, you maintain that central code repository, you can put whatever sort of base plugins and things that you want in there, and then each site within that uses that upstream can also have their own custom code. And for a long time, Pantheon was really pushing people toward upstreams instead of multi-site. And then I kind of said, don't do that. because there's a need. There's two different needs, right? And the way that I ultimately are sort of articulated the difference between that kind of an architecture and multi-site is where if a singular database with overlapping users and a shared ability to like pull up content from different sites, if that is a single database home for all of the data, is a feature and not a bug, then that's a good argument for multi-site. But if you want distinct stacks with separate governance over data and users and whatever, then that's a good it's better to do that as a as sort of a single WordPress site. Do you see that sort of same kind of tension too when you're working with especially because I know that in some cases, not all, but in some cases, particularly under the EDU umbrella, they do want to have really distinct data governance and like no, we don't want our users touching those users over there, even if they're like, even if they're only touching sort of superficially, like just share a database, but like not accessing those sites.
Yeah, so in our environment, everything that we are doing, at least in this current multi-site, is public facing. So we don't really get into the conversations of the data that's in the database from that level. We do actually have a setup in place where we build security groups that work with our Active Directory. And then, so if I add you into a security group, you have access to sites A, B, and C, but that's the limit of where you can go. We also leverage editor roles, so at least when you log in there, you don't have access to everything an admin have, and that's a wise choice to make sure that folks that don't really truly understand what plugins and themes do and what they're for, and they don't need to understand that. We like to curate that editor experience a lot too, so that way at least someone who's coming in can get in, get what they need to do done as quickly as they can, and then move out and go on to all the other things they need to do during their day.
So HumanMade worked with WP Campus over the summer to build out a sort of a state of WordPress in higher education report. And one of the results of that that I distinctly remember and have been thinking about basically ever since is the amount of sort of training that teams need to do. And this could be whatever development team, whoever's touching WordPress the most, those teams need to do like a significant amount of training to the actual users of the site. Just like getting people familiar with and comfortable working with WordPress. Do you see that as well at Carleton?
Absolutely. It's definitely a critical piece. I don't feel like it's good for us to provide folks with a site and not at least give them some sort of an intro, sort of overview tutorial, provide solid documentation. We're really big on video tutorials. So our process right now is when someone gets a site, we do offer them some training, whether it be them one-on-one or if they have a small group within their department or their unit that needs to manage content. So we do offer that. We also have a great site that offers a lot of written tutorials, and then we do a lot of video tutorials on top of that. And the person on my team, Charlotte, who had put all of that information together, made a really nice flow. So it's almost like course style where you come in, you start with like the first section, you move your way deeper, you get into the advanced stuff. So she's really tailored something that you can follow along as if you're taking a course. So I feel those are really important things for our end users to make sure that they're comfortable. But I also find that by doing good training and offering good documentation, it will reduce the amount of support we have to do.
Did you ever look at, or at least during your time, have you, has your team looked at other CMSs? Like, has Drupal ever been on the table?
I don't think so. I mean, I kind of came into Carleton. I came here in 2009, and at that time, there was already a project in place to start moving a few sites. Those things, 36 sites, I believe, into WordPress to do a pilot project. So, at that time, like the whatever decisions were made were already made before I kind of came on board. So I don't really know how that came about.
Talk about switch gears and talk about a little bit your involvement in WordCamp Canada. How did that come about? And maybe I guess what's a little bit different that from your perception about the Canadian WordPress community that would be distinct from the rest of the North American WordPress community or other parts of the WordPress ecosystem besides your Abootes and A's.
I got involved. I mean, I was an organizer for WordCamp Ottawa for several years before COVID happened. So now when all that sort of kind of I can't say went away, but
Right.
when COVID wasn't the hot topic anymore and camp started to come back, there was a few folks from previous WordCamp Ottawa organizing teams that got together and they wanted to put on WordCamp Ottawa. So after going to that last year and talking to some of the organizers and some old friends there, and I said, like, I'm interested in helping out next year, like, what can I do? And then the call for new organizers came out, and I submitted, and I wasn't able to make it to that first meeting, but I think they had already had an understanding that I was already committed at that point. So I remember getting a follow-up. I believe it was from Shanta within a couple of days after that. And she said, yeah, congratulations, you're part of the team. And we just kind of went from there.
What brought you into the original WordCamp Ottawa group in the first place? What drew you to the WordPress community in that way?
I think it was just wanting to get involved, wanting to meet new people and find resources and get networking. Like, we were doing a lot of the stuff at the times, so when we were learning as well, and you could go online and find all those resources, but there's also something about having that connection to be able to just message someone or have a chat with them and get that information and exchange stories. And to me, like, it's one thing to go online, but I love communities like Slack, like what we can do on Make and what we can do on Post Status and the people that are there and the resources you have. And like, those are very invaluable. So for me at that time, I wanted to become a part of a community and start to meet more people who had similar interests to me. The first WordCamp Ottawa happened at U of O, sorry, University of Ottawa, I should clarify that. And I actually got to speak at that one. I applied to speak and I got to speak at that one. And it was my first experience with a local camp, my first experience with speaking. And I just wanted to become a part of that moving forward. It kind of goes back to, I think about, and I wrote a post on the WordCamp Canada site about this, about my first experience at a WordCamp. And I got lucky and I went to Toronto in 2009, and that was my first camp experience. And that was a really great experience. Like, I still have lasting friendships from that camp. And that was something that I really picked up on quickly, is that the friendships that you make in this community, are very strong friendships, and they will be with you for a long time. And that's one of the beauties of a WordCamp. Like, I walk away from WordCamps not only with knowledge, but new friends that I know I can reach out and out to and ask questions to at any point, and they're all going to be super helpful.
Yeah, that was actually a thing that I wrote about in my recap post for WordCamp Canada, was that it's been a number of years since I've been to a WordCamp that wasn't a big WordCamp, that was a more local or yeah, more local WordCamp. And Canada, WordCamp Canada is kind of a weird outlier. We can talk about that in a second too, but like, it's still, I mean, it capped at like 250 people, right? So like something like that. So like, it's still compared to US or EU, it's like significantly smaller. And that's about the size of WordCamp Salt Lake City when I was running that. That's probably where we sort of maxed out at, is that sort of range. And it the thing that I took away the most from that was that it really felt like all WordCamps to a degree for me at this point, since I've been around the WordPress ecosystem for a long time, feel like an opportunity to like reconnect with old friends, people that I worked with at other agencies or whatever. But it really felt like, because it was smaller, it felt like even more concentrated, and it felt like, no, these are people that like I'm happy to spend time with. Even the new people, even the people that I just met, at the event, and that was one of the things that like I really took away from being at WordCamp Canada. From your perspective, having organized or been involved in WordCamp Ottawa and WordCamp Canada, were there any differences in how the Canadian WordCamp was organized versus the Ottawa, the sort of local WordCamp?
Yeah, I think there was quite a few, but before that, there was a question that you had posed a bit earlier about the differences between a WordCamp in Canada versus a WordCamp in the US. Now, I haven't gone to a lot of camps outside of Canada. I got to go to the last San Fran, actually, right before it became WordCamp US. I was in San Francisco in
I was there too.
2014. Oh yeah, nice. So, and that was so large to me. That was very overwhelming. Like, I come from a really small town. Ottawa, I call it the big city, but a little town. It was a lot. It was a lot to take in. What I find the biggest difference is the scale. So I find it, and like you just mentioned, like coming to something like WordCamp with less people, it just felt more personal, and you were talking to some of the folks for longer periods of time because you weren't, surrounded by like a couple thousand people. You're surrounded by a couple hundred people. So those conversations, I find, can get a bit more intimate, or they can go on for longer because you're not trying to figure out who do I need to go see now, or who can I go meet? Oh, no, that's that person over there that I want to go see. Like, I just that's what I found from San Fran, compared to what we do up here in Canada.
I remember going to WordCamp San Francisco 2013, 2014, and feeling, yes, overwhelmed. I had the deep sense that like there are people that I recognize their like handles that I was like afraid to have a conversation with, because like this is a big important person and I'm just a like whatever. So like there's a lot of imposter syndrome. Like there are people that I wanted to talk to or introduce myself to, but I was afraid to. And that was also, I mean, that was a long, long, long time ago. And since then I did a bunch of speaking and I was involved in Salt Lake City and whatever. But yeah, it was definitely like a lot, it felt a lot harder to get into that sort of mode of networking. And I think I almost felt like a failure too, like walking away from that and not having those conversations, because like I felt like this is your opportunity to like get into the in crowd or whatever, and like they're right there, you can just say hi, and it's like no, I am too much of a wallflower. Like I'm very much of the like I get a lot out of being in social situations, but I also like if I don't know people, it's really hard for me to like motivate myself to get into to insert myself into a conversation with people that I just have never sort of met in person or met at all, really. So I go ahead.
I completely understand. Like, I find myself I'm awkward at best when it comes to the majority of social situations. So, usually if it's a group of folks, I'm a bit more comfortable if I know at least one person in that group. But I find, like, going back to like San Fran 12 years ago versus, even just WordCamp just a couple of weeks ago, I found like I've really kind of opened up, and my ability to go and approach some of those folks that probably would have intimidated me 12 years ago. That was so going back to San Fran, I got the opportunity to meet Mark. Is his last name pronounced Jaques, I
Jaques,
believe? Yeah, so I got the chance to meet him at one point. I had a conversation with him, and I think for me that was the eye-opening moment, and that was really towards the end of the camp. And but he was so friendly, he was so approachable, and that to me was like, okay, at that time, him and like Andrew Nason, like those were like sort of the big guys in the WordPress world at that time. And for him to be very approachable and really open to conversation and stuff, that showed me what this community was really all about. And there was really not a lot of ego that you get from a lot of other conferences and stuff like that. So that made me really appreciate the community that much more. Now, fast forward into WordCamp Canada, like we had a lot of big names at that camp. I mean, Matt was at the camp, and he was very approachable as well. There probably would have been a time and place when I would not have wanted to go and talk to some of those folks, but this time I relished that opportunity and was really excited to meet some of the names that we had coming in.
I remember Jaques and Nason. I remember seeing them across the room and being too intimidated to talk to them. So you props to you, props to 2013 you for actually opening the conversation when I couldn't. So you've been working on this Gutenberg block accessibility validation plugin. Tell me about how, I mean, I imagine, I think I can maybe even see where the sort of origin story for this thing, because if you're working at Carleton and Carleton is concerned about accessibility, then obviously your website needs to be accessible, and there needs to be a way to inform the users of the site that the site isn't super accessible. So I imagine that that just sort of like is the use case for how this emerged. What sort of, I guess, when did you decide that this was something that you needed to work on and build?
It was pretty early when we were building our current Gutenberg implementation, where the realization of how easy it was to publish inaccessible content with Gutenberg, it was a bit mind-blowing, to be honest. Like, for example, the table block, the fact that I can just throw a table block on the page, there's no header by default. And at the time, maybe it's changed in code, in the last year, but at the time I was looking at it, there was not a way to force the header on by default without doing a variation block, nor was there a way to remove that option from the editor. So there was always a way to allow a table block to be published without a header. At one point, I was trying to figure out how we could, tackle this stuff. There was really no validation in core that I knew about at the time, but I saw a video by Ryan Welcher. And he had been talking about the post-locking functionality in core. And the light bulb turned on immediately. I said, how can I check attributes in blocks, then block post-publishing if they didn't meet the accessibility requirements that we have to adhere to in Canada? So I started just to build this thing on my own, trying to figure it out. And one thing led to another, and a first iteration of a plugin came together. Where I was checking, I think it was, I started with the table block. I added the button block because I wanted to make sure that folks were not able to publish buttons without text or a link. And I also started working on images because alt tags, in my opinion, are one of the biggest misses as far as accessibility goes. And then I just kept working on this plugin, and we had a different iteration of it internally. So there was some separation that had happened there because we do things just a little bit different. Like we force it all internally and it's all required. Whereas the plugin that I'm building for public consumption allows you as a content editor to choose your level of, I guess, validation and what you want to validate. So there's a big settings page. And, if you're not as concerned around heading levels or structures, or if you don't care about the table header, you can turn it all off. Or you can give warnings as a way to, at least educate folks, but not block them from publishing. Or you can be as heavy-handed as we are at the university and just make sure that folks just can't do it at all. Over the summer, though, I think was the biggest thing I really wanted to do with the plugin itself. And I built a validation API ultimately. I like the idea that the plugin offered the ability to validate some of the core blocks. But to me, the big win was being able to allow other developers to leverage all of the stuff that I had already written in the most simplistic of ways. So I happened to go on vacation to Newfoundland and my family were going to bed a bit earlier. So that gave me hours and hours at night to just tinker with this. And I think in the course of a 2-week vacation, I had built the majority of this. I called it at the time the developer API. And I started building some of my own little plugins with it to test it. And now it's a fully functioning API. And just a couple of days ago, I extended that functionality to now include post meta in the validation in the same way. So yeah, there's some other stuff I want to do with this plugin. And I'm really just trying to position it as a really fantastic, powerful validation API for developers.
Have you been getting any sort of like feedback or conversation around the plugin? I know that when we talked in person, you were talking about Joe Dolson, who is very active in the WordPress accessibility community, had submitted some pull requests. But have you been able to like interact with people that are using it?
Not as much as I would like to, and I find that is one of the hardest parts about this world right now because there's so many options. There's a lot of great accessibility tools out there, so it's hard to catch the attention. And I'm not really a well-known person either, so again, I'm already fighting that uphill battle. Now, I did get some really great feedback from some folks like Joe, you mentioned, for example, had saw the plugin and submitted a few feature requests. So I kind of pinged Joe on the side and talked to him a little bit and really appreciate, him taking the time to put those features in, and they made it into the next release. I had some conversations with a lot of folks at WordCamp Canada. One of the goals was I wanted to try to sit down with some more developers and get some feedback and demo my plugin. So I got a lot of great feedback there. I've since put in a long list of issues of things I want to build it on the plugin. One of my favorite ideas, and it's something I actually have started working on already, came from Ryan Welcher. He had suggested, what does the possibility of moving away from writing the checks and the strings and all that in PHP, what would that look like if I moved it to the block.json? And that would just remove one whole other layer and then simplify the integration for an external block. So I thought that was a fantastic idea. So now I'm trying to figure that out, but that also means I need to wrap my head around how translation works. And how does that work when you're pulling a string from a block.json? I've never had to handle that before. So I'm actually quite excited for the challenge and learning how that works. And I'm going to need to find someone that knows how to properly test it to tell me if I did my job correctly or not, though.
What kind of approaches are you using? Do you, or I guess maybe the first question is, do you have sort of testing in place as you're building out the plugin, or is are you mostly just sort of testing things manually as you go?
Right now, it's all just manual because I want to be able to get in there and see how the experience is in the editor. I mean, I definitely do need to go in and start adding some unit tests before things start to grow a little bit too big, but I don't think I'll ever get away from the manual testing because, to me, the plugins also got to feel good for the users. And there's no testing unit that's going to tell me if that's a good experience or not. So there's always going to be an aspect of the human element has always got to be here, because I'm a big proponent of making sure that the UI is as clean and as nice as it can be for the end user.
What are your what was what would success sort of look like for the block validation plugin in your mind? Like, what are you hoping that this will sort of achieve if you reach your goals?
I mean, I have a couple of pretty lofty goals. I mean, I think realistically, I mean, more developers seeing this plugin and looking at it as a viable solution in their work in order to help validate blocks or post meta. I would love to know that more people are using it and it's working well for them, and then maybe we get some more contributors that can help grow the plugin. I think that would be a best case scenario. I mean, if I wanted to look at big picture, I mean, I keep seeing stuff like the Abilities API and the Interactivity API crop up in WordPress. I really do truly think we need a validations API. And I think at some point I might just take what I've done and throw it up as a discussion and hope for the best. That's my pie in the sky. And, I don't know where it's going to go until I put it out there in the universe. And I fully plan on doing that at some point.
That's awesome. I agree. I think it would be really I think it's really valuable just from a user education standpoint. I've played with it a little bit. I probably haven't configured it to the right degree because I really just sort of threw it up on this site actually just to get a sense of what it does. But even just from the perspective of knowing when you're doing things wrong, like it seems like it should be like it's like you said, it's super easy to not even realize that you're creating inaccessible content. And so just from like an education standpoint, like I know because I've worked with I mean I worked with Rian Ritveld, who's like one of the like biggest accessibility advocates in the WordPress ecosystem and probably beyond, and like just is amazing to work alongside. And she has drilled several things into my brain over the years of working with her. But like it's still like it's there's because it's so easy, because there's so much variability, and because like the rules aren't super fixed. Like there's things where it's like, well, in this case, images are a great example. In this case, like you definitely need alt text, but in this case, the image is just decorative, so it doesn't necessarily need alt text. Like there's nuance, and it really requires accessibility really requires like a human in the loop. So just having something that gives you feedback that kind of suggests like, hey, maybe you should be doing this thing is super valuable. And I do think that pulling that into core is maybe a lofty goal, but it shouldn't be super unrealistic. Like I feel like it's a thing that could be really valuable to anyone.
No, thank you. I like to think so.
So let us switch gears a little bit to you mentioned before the recording that you're a little bit of a RPG nerd. Let's get into the nerdiness. What sort of nerd things are you what are you nerding out on these days?
Well, I haven't jumped into games in quite some time. I mean, the last year of life between building this validation stuff and doing the WordCamp work has, consumed a lot of my time. And then, everything else is all about the family. So, but now that WordCamp is done, and I'm stepping back a little bit on like developing for 5 and 6 hours every night after I, develop all day at work. I'm jumping into Ghosts of Yote was a newer game. So I really enjoyed the last Ghosts of Tsushima. Now there's also a couple of RPGs that are on my wish list. I was reading about one the other day. The name escapes me, but I'm trying to catch up from like the last couple of years of gaming releases. I also just grabbed a copy of Elder Scrolls Online. I'm quite interested in that one. It also seems like something my wife might enjoy. She's also an RPG fan, so looking for something that we might be able to play together would be ideal, especially for the winter.
What draws you into role playing video games specifically? Like what was the sort of your introduction and like what was the thing that like pulled you in and was like, yeah, this is the thing for me.
Everything about the Final Fantasy series is what drew me into games. When I was growing up, I mean, I got the Nintendo Entertainment System, and everybody was playing Mario and Duck Hunt, and I got Final Fantasy. And it was game over for me right from that point. There's just something about leveling and building a character. And then, of course, as RPGs evolved over time, being able to customize that character and not being locked into what that game and what that creator was trying to make this character be. So you kind of break outside of the mold. And I think you can relate it back to a lot of the D&D stuff. I didn't really play a lot of that as a kid. I did just maybe for a year or so, but just the idea that what you're creating is unique to you. You can do whatever you want to do with it. And I think that aspect of RPGs is really appealing to me. Just And the open world concept and just being able to get lost in those things for hours on end. And I mean, I remember playing Skyrim, and I think the first month or so I played Skyrim, I played for like 40 hours, but I accomplished nothing in the big picture because it was all about exploring and leveling and building the character and like just fun stuff like that that I like to get lost in.
I really enjoy the thing that I love the most about role playing, whether it's video games or whether it's tabletop role playing games or even like some tabletop board games even. Is like the storytelling is getting lost in a story. And I remember the first time, I remember when I played Final Fantasy VII back in the day, it blew me away, like the level of, like before that, it felt like the story was kind of like, oh, your princess is in another castle. And like it was there, but like it was a little bit like forced, but like Final Fantasy VII, like Chrono Cross, like things like that, where like the story is really, really immersive and deep, and like even like Kingdom Hearts, the like it was really like elevating video games to an art form that was really like on the same level as like reading Lord of the Rings, like except that you are Frodo.
Yeah, I remember times when like just my friends and I would like, oh, the new Final Fantasy's coming, or here's the launch trailer, and we would like just totally geek out over the animations of all the deities or daikons or whatever they decided to call them in those games. And you'd see like Bahamut like rise up and how great the graphics were. Like those were like just I remember those being super exciting moments to get to see the improvements. Because to me, I found RPGs had the biggest graphical improvement year over year with what they were trying to put out there with the stories.
Right.
And like you said, with the story, like you also need to have those really strong visuals. Like you had to make it look like you were watching a movie at
Yeah.
times. And Final Fantasy, in my opinion, did it leagues above everybody else to a certain degree. And it was just always excited to see what they were going to come up with next. So I always have a special place for Final Fantasy in my gaming heart.
Did you ever get into those sort of interactive movie style games? I'm thinking of things like Phantasmagoria. I think Wing Commander had one where it was like they like Wing Commander is a great example because they had Mark Hamill play one of the characters. And so they have actual actors, and but it's really like the game itself is like almost like a Myst style point and click sort of thing, but then with these like live action clips interspersed depending on like what you unlock or what you find. Did you ever get into to those sorts of things?
There's one that really stands out, and I absolutely loved this game. I like Sean Ashmore as an actor, and he did Quantum Break. That
Okay.
game was fantastic on the Xbox. So that had that sort of like you'd play the game, and then there'd be like a movie clip, and like you would sit. There was, I think, one part that was like a 25-minute clip. I was watching an episode essentially.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that game. Like it was a good break from something where it's like action, like nonstop, versus this game had a good action. Then you could sit back and it felt like something I wanted to have snacks. I don't snack when I'm gaming, but this was one of those ones where I definitely had to have snacks because I was essentially watching a movie and that I just got to play in between clips, right?
I remember thinking that at the time that that was the future of what games were going to turn into, like they were going to be more cinematic and more cinematic in from like a production value. And I mean, honestly, that's not true. It's just it's not that thing that I thought it was at the time, right? Like I thought I was so adamant that that was like where gaming was going to that my senior year in college, my plan was, I didn't actually do this thing, but my plan was that I would spend one semester. So I was my final project, my senior project was going to be like one of those sort of point and click kind of interactive movie sort of games. And so the first semester we were going to spend filming all the video stuff. The second semester is me figuring out how to turn that into a game. And I ultimately didn't do that second part. We did the movie. I did an interactive CD-ROM instead, but like I had was just convinced that like that was going to be the future. And of course, that's not those games pretty much died off, but they were replaced by things like, I mean, you look at Baldur's Gate 3, which is one of the top grosses, the most highly grossing games in I don't know how long, ever, maybe, I don't know. But like I mean, the budgets are definitely there. There's like professional voice actors doing things, doing the voice acting. In a lot of cases, there's like mocap, like, you know, like the actors are doing things that are being recorded, and the cutscenes and things are a lot of times cinema quality. And now, like, the graphics are getting to the point where, like it's pretty darn close. I mean, if you compare that to like even just film CGI like from 10 years ago, like we're way beyond that in terms of what you could just run on a PC. I think that it's just where things have gone is really interesting. And things it does feel like things are moving or have already moved in a it to elevate video games into something that is comparable to filmmaking and, you know, novels and like, I mean, it really is to me like an art form.
Yeah, if I'm correct, I think the video game industry is actually bigger as far as like it's at how much it makes compared to the movie industry and the music industry too. So it's probably one of the biggest grossing forms of entertainment going right now.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. So Ghost of Yokai, I've heard about that. Tell me about what is exciting about Ghost of Yokai. I know about it because I think there's some Critical Role friends and and voice actors that are doing some of the stuff in there. So that's how I've heard of it.
Yeah, no, I haven't dove into the game yet. I actually just installed it over the weekend,
Sweet.
but I played the first version, which was called Ghosts of Tsushima. And that game, I think I put in about 90 hours into that game. Like, it's just an unreal amount of time. I loved it so much. I think I finished it. I could have probably finished it in about a 40, 45 hour mark, but it was just, there was something about it. I just enjoyed going to do all of those extra side quests. Like, I find most games, once you get to the end game, it feels repetitive and you just don't care anymore. No, this game, I wanted more. So I chose to not go and complete the game because I just wanted to keep exploring and kept going. And somewhere around the 90 hour mark, I decided, all right, it's time to wrap this up and move on. It's been like 6 months. There's, tons of other games, but there's something about the samurai genre and the way that game controlled and the way it felt. It just felt really good. It was fun. The combat system was great. It had enough of an upgrade system to keep my interest going. So when I saw the next one get announced, I immediately pre-ordered it and I looked at it and I said, well, that comes out right before WordCamp. So I'll see you in November. And here we are,
Here
and
we
I'm
are in
about to
November.
dive in.
Yeah.
So.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Troy, for coming on. For anyone who's interested in learning more about you or finding you online, where can people find you?
I just actually rebooted my personal site for the first time in a decade. So I'm now going to be blogging at troychaplin.ca. You can also find me on PostStatus or Make WordPress if you have any questions or want to touch base. Or if you want more information around the block accessibility work I'm doing, you can check out blockaccessibilitychecks.com. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it.
And the plugin is on WordPress.org, so you can
Yes, it
download it
is.
just in your WordPress admin and install it and play around with it. Well, thanks again, Troy, for coming on. Thank you, everyone who is watching or listening to this in the future. And for everyone else, we'll see you on the internet.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Chris.